calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Thomas Jefferson: "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." Our question theme for the day: has the public soured on government and business? And I want to get into this question. Will Fitzgerald take his investigation, the bigger picture, and investigate the lies that led us to Iraq and the outing of Valerie Plame? Also, what's going on with Sam Alito? I keep wanting to say Joe Alioto, the old mayor of San Francisco. I lived briefly in San Francisco when he was mayor back in the late 60s, and his name is stuck in my head for some reason today. Anyhow, Sam Alito. And we're going to get into the details of this guy who has already voted on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that women should get the permission of their husbands, or at least how is it phrased? It wasn't permission. They must notify their husbands before they get an abortion, which raises an interesting question about, you know, how do you demonstrate notification? To whom do you demonstrate it? What if a husband refuses to acknowledge that he has been notified? Do you have to notify? Does that proof of notification have to go to the physician or to the police? It's like, at what point does the government stick its nose into our lives and into our business? Robert Garmong is with us with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And I suspect, Robert, this is, although we're going to talk about something completely different here in just a moment, but with regard to this whole thing around abortion and women's rights, I suspect you and I are on the same page.
Oh, yeah, definitely, Tom.
Yeah,
I think as far as his judicial philosophy, I don't really know enough to comment, but I certainly think that the abortion issue is something to be very, very concerned about with this nomination.
Yeah, yeah. This, among other things, I find it interesting. Well, we'll get into this a little later, but I find it interesting that he's also now he will be the fifth Catholic on the court, and this is I certainly don't mean this as an anti-Catholic screed. In fact, in a way, it's kind of a cool thing because for well over 100 years in the United States, it was very rare to see Catholics in politics because there was such strong anti-papacy or they called them papists or papists or whatever, anti-Catholic, basically, discrimination in the United States. And, you know, on the other hand, however, my concern is that this is a church that has aggressively inserted itself into politics. We have the current pope sending letters back when he was the head of the office that used to be called the Inquisition, sending letters to bishops across the United States during the 2004 election, essentially asserting that if they gave communion to John Kerry, that they would be committing a crime in the eyes of the church, and which, you know, led to a huge flap. And so, you know, this is a church that's very strongly opposed to abortion rights for women and to birth control, for that matter, rights for women. And yet it's also a church that's strongly opposed to capital punishment. So I don't know to what extent, you know, and to the war in Iraq, for that matter. So I don't know to what extent that's going to influence any of this, if at all.
If you ask me, I think this illustrates a really crucial distinction between judicial philosophy and political philosophy or political policy. And I'm worried about this nomination, but I approve of one aspect of the Catholic Church, and that is they do have a natural rights tradition. They have a view that, and I know you and I have some disagreements on what that means exactly, but they do believe that there is an authority which precedes government and that our rights are not provided by the government, but by, in their case, they believe in a God who grants us our rights. In my case, I believe it's a human nature that grants us our rights. So to the extent that they believe in an absolute natural right, I think Catholics are uniquely able to defend individual rights in a way that I think is good. The problem is, of course, their interpretation of what those rights are, and that's where public policy comes in.
And where the limits of those rights are.
That's right. And yeah. So I think that if we see this nominee turn into a judicial Catholic and not a public policy Catholic, if I can allow that distinction on the bench, then I will be glad for his nomination. But I'm very concerned that he's going to try to import public policy views from his church into the public arena, and that would be very dangerous.
Well, time will tell. We're talking with Robert Garmong. He's with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. And Robert, what we were going to talk about today, and I really think that it's still a conversation that we need to have, is our difference of opinion about what we should be doing in Iraq. We have roughly 17,000 Americans who have either died or been severely wounded in Iraq. The toll is continuing to mount. We have spent an absolute mind-boggling amount of money in Iraq. We've been in Iraq from the time from 9/11 till today is longer than the time from Pearl Harbor to the end of World War II. You have a suggestion for Iraq that I frankly think is wrong, but I'll let you put it out here and let's have it out.
Okay, great, Tom. Yeah, I think the interesting phenomenon, there's a little noted implication of the recent referendum on the Constitution in Iraq. You know, before that referendum, the big question was, who are these insurgents? Are they just nihilistic al-Qaeda types who are out to destroy us for the sake of destroying us or because of our supposedly decadent Western lifestyle or whatever? Or are they people of the political variety who want to, who are striving for power in the same way that, for instance, the Italian anarchist bombers were in the 1980s.
Actually, if you're only putting in those two, I'd say you're missing the third group, which is probably the largest, which is nationalists, people who are simply saying, hey, this is my nation, or these are my tribal lands, or this is my family land, get out.
That's right, that's right. And those I would more or less fold into the power-seeking group, because they're seeking power for a particular purpose, which is namely to get us out and get their agenda in. But whatever, the basic question is, do they have a political agenda or do they not? Are they simply destroying us for the sake of destroying us, or are they after something concrete?
Well, wouldn't it be rather childlike to think that they're just destroying us for the sake of destroying us, the way that Bush asserts, you know, that they're just evil?
That's right, and our administration has adopted that official policy that these are simply nihilistic bombers, and certainly some of them are. I mean, the straight-up al-Qaeda suicide bombers are simply, it's not.
I don't think those guys are even nihilists. I mean, they want to see, you know, another sultan. There are folks who want to reform the Middle East, and they don't want us part of it, or Israel for that matter. But really the bottom line here, Robert Garmong, and we don't have much time left for this, is you're suggesting that we should basically bomb these guys back to the Stone Age, that we should have an absolute military victory like we did in World War II.
That's right. My view is that as long as they're after something, a seat at the political table, if what they're after is power, we need to make it very clear that there is no power vacuum. Right now we've set up a power vacuum, a struggle for control over the next Iraq, and we've allowed it to be the case that anyone who goes grabbing for it thinks he might get some. I think the only way to do it is to have an absolute victory and to impose from without a constitution that would be a preliminary one, perhaps, in the way that we did in Japan.
We've already done that, though. We rewrote their constitution. Paul Bremer did that. Didn't work.
Yeah, well, they did it
In fact, he followed a lot of your philosophies. He went in 15% flat tax on everybody. Corporations can do anything they want. Open borders. It was a libertarian paradise, and it was a disaster.
Well, I think that it was done rather poorly.
They banned unions?
It was not done in a way that was sensitive to the local context. And it was done without the kind of military power that we needed. I'm very critical of the Bush administration for their halfway victory and their halfway troop commitment and the idea that we could do this on the cheap. And if we were going to go in there, and I didn't think this was the right war, I agreed with John Kerry, this was the wrong war at the wrong time. But if we were going to go in there, we needed to have a decisive victory, and we needed to impose on them a constitution that would nonetheless be sensitive to and developed from local institutions.
Yeah, and see, this is where I think that this is a destructive, simplistic mindset that really is causing our problem. Japan and Germany were monolithic cults. Iraq is a multi-ethnic, no-cult nation that's been occupied and has no functional government. I mean, the difference is night and day. And bombing them back to the Stone Age is only going to cause 1 billion Muslims all around the world to start a war against us, if they haven't already.
Well, I and I don't literally believe in bombing them back to the Stone Age.
No, but you'd be willing to put up with a lot of civilian casualties to impose this ultimate victory that you're talking about, would you not?
There certainly would be a lot of civilian casualties, but my guess is there would be fewer than there are currently, because as we have seen, the attempt to do the war the way we are doing it now from a distance.
Yeah. It's not working.
Strikes.
And my position is just that, you know, we've become the irritant. It's if we back out that these guys will work things out. But, you know, time will tell. Robert Garmong, thanks for being with us. AyanRand.org. You can read more about his thoughts. Specialize in political theory and ethics at the Ayn Rand Institute. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Ah, it's Halloween.
We were hiking past the White House late one night when our eyes beheld an eerie sight. The president appeared with folks very strange, the zombies and vampires of global climate change. It's not global warming, say oil company disciples. Our math tells us it's natural weather cycles. These claims from industry heavies, let the president rest behind his own protective levees. They're doing the climate mash.
This is Boris Pickett.
Real science is bad. Solutions are trash. And they do it for the cash. The creatures were having fun. Our Congress was overrun. We couldn't tell the mindless zombies from the elected ones. Now we can stop this. We have the technology. But first we have to get past industry ideology. We need your help. I'm glad to show you how. Tell your leaders in Washington to save our climate now.
You're doing a heck of a job, zombie. Hey, the snow melted. Great. So we can drill over here. Yeehaw.
And over here. At Boris Pickett. The climatemash.org is the website. And it actually is Boris Pickett, the guy who did the original Monster Mash. He's recut it as Climate Mash and has it right there on the internet for you to check out at climatemash.org. And appropriate music, I think, for Halloween.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, we... I was going to say, we check out the Reich so you don't have to. But this is, you know, to borrow a phrase from the Fox Watch folks, who we will actually going to have on later on today. But here are the right-wing talking points for the day from behind enemy lines. The main right-wing talking point for the day. Anybody who implies that Sam Alito might be like Scalia by calling him Scalito is a racist. That they are doing the same thing as using the old slur words that were used against Italian Americans for so many years in the United States. In fact, this morning, this of course the big meme being promoted on the Drudge website. Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, was on Fox News this morning. And he said he warned senators, be very careful here, because a vote against the leader would be held against them by Italian Americans. All right, get this. This is quoting Orrin Hatch. They think they own the Italian American vote all up and down the East Coast. They don't, but they think that he's referring to Democrats. They don't, but they think they do. If they become offensive against somebody with the qualifications of Sam Alito, Judge Alito, then I think it's going to be held against them. They're going to have to be very careful how they handle this. And frankly, what bothers me, if 22, in other words, half the Democrats in the Senate, could vote against John Roberts, can you imagine what this nomination is going to be like? There's no reason they should have voted against Roberts, and I think Alito's going to be just fine. We're all going to have to work really hard to make sure that that's so. End of quote. Nico notes over at the thinkprogress.org blog, conservatives could have picked any number of topics to distract Americans from the real issues about Alito's nomination. This is among the most cynical and crass. It's racist to call him Scalito. Now, this is after George W. Bush himself said he was going to nominate somebody in the mold of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. And Scalia and Thomas have created their own little two-man faction on the court. Scalia calls it originalism. He's invented this new brand of interpretation of the Constitution, originalism. And Clarence Thomas has signed onto it with him. Clarence Thomas, of course, also being the guy that Scalia helped convert to Catholicism. Interesting. This would and as I said, I just don't know the meaning of this. That that five of the nine justices on the Supreme Court may be Catholic. I think it's probably a first. Certainly, the court has been dominated in the past by Protestants. For better or for worse. It's not like, you know, there's a religious thing here, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see. Time will tell. As Robert said, we'll see if he's legislating or if he's making decisions based on his religion or on the Constitution. Alito apparently doesn't think that $500,000 is a conflict of interest, by the way. He was asked to rule in a case in Virginia. As a member of the U.S. Circuit Court of the Third Appeals, where this is from the Philadelphia Inquirer in 2002, Samuel Alito, a member of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals of the Third Circuit, has been accused of conflict of interest by a woman whose suit he and other appeals judges dismissed. According to Alito's 2002 financial disclosure statement, the judge held investments worth between $390,000 and $930,000 in 11 Vanguard funds in July of 2002 when he ruled on a lawsuit filed by Shanti Maharaj of Wayne against Vanguard. So, you know, he's got $500,000 invested with them, so he'll rule their way, but that's not going to. His argument was this company has a $600 billion fund. And, you know, ruling against them in the case of this woman's lawsuit was not going to affect his investment and therefore no problem. And they dismissed it, although apparently it came before him because later on he eventually did recuse himself. So first it's wrong, then it's right, then it just doesn't really matter. But I'll tell you, the big meme of the day on the Reich wing is going to be anybody who calls Alito Scullito is an anti-Italian racist, when in fact... Well, I'll give you some of the actual quotes on this in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet you're going to regret, because I'm the best as ever been." "Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia, and the devil deals at cards."
Indeed, welcome back, my friends. Yeah, all hell broke loose in Georgia. I'll tell you, when Diebold came in and the other voting machine companies and said, okay, we're going to have the entire state vote on machines that produce no paper trail in the 2002 election, and suddenly Max Cleland, who is way ahead in the polls, is way behind on the electronic voting machines. That's when all hell broke loose in Georgia. Anyhow, a little Halloween-themed music here throughout the day. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. One outraged Republican strategist, according to Matt Drudge, claimed, quote, "If Alito were a liberal, there would be no way Democrats in Washington's media elite would use such an ethnically insensitive nickname." Now, Italian-Americans should not have to face these types of derogatory racial slurs in 21st century America. That's the meme that got put out this morning on the Drudge Report. Probably came out of, you know, some sort of focus group testing that was done by, well, who knows, Frank Luntz or whatever. And has already been picked up by Orrin Hatch and used on Fox News. I don't, you know, there are several words that are used as slurs to describe Italian Americans. I don't recall any of them that start with S. I'm just culturally ignorant. You know, I know of one that starts with a D and one that starts with a W, but I don't know of any that starts with an S. And so to call Alito Scully toe is an ethnic slur, I don't get. I don't get it. It doesn't make sense to me. I must be missing something. But and you know, perhaps you can illuminate me if there's something that I'm completely overlooking here. Feel free to call me and set me straight. Our telephone number 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And of course, you can drop into our live chat room by going to TomHartmann.com and clicking on live chat. But anyhow, this is the meme. This is the story that the cons are putting out, that if you call Alito Scullito, you're a racist. Well, I'm sorry. I don't think of myself as a racist. I'm certainly not anti-Italian. And I think Scullito is perfectly appropriate given the fact. Well, here, actually, rather than don't take my word for it. Let's just go here to some of the, you know, wire services. Here, the Associated Press today. Quoting from the Associated Press. So consistently conservative, Alito has been dubbed Scullito or Scullita Light by some lawyers because his judicial philosophy invites comparisons to conservative Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. End of quote from the Associated Press. Didn't hear anything in there about Italy. The Austin American Statesman. Quote, often called Scullito because he closely adheres to Justice Antonin Scalia's legal philosophy, Alito, 55, has sat on the third U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the past 15 years, where he has been a consistently dissenting conservative voice. End of quote. Again, I didn't notice Italian in there anywhere. Maybe I'm missing something. The Chicago Tribune. A couple days ago, on the 28th, a strong conservative voice in his 15 years on the Philadelphia-based 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, he has been dubbed Scullito because his judicial philosophy invites comparisons to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Don't see anything about being Italian there. Back in September, on September 4th of this year, the Associated Press wrote, quote, he has been dubbed Scullito or Scullita Light. Now, this isn't something new. This isn't some smear that liberals came up with yesterday or today. Now, this I'm reading from a story that's, almost 2 months old. He has been dubbed Scullito or Scalia Light by some lawyers because his judicial philosophy invites comparisons to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. End of quote. The Houston Chronicle, not exactly a liberal rag. This back from May of 5 years ago. May 26th, 2000. Judge Samuel Alito Jr., 50. So he's 55 now. This is 5 years ago. 50 of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Alito of Newark, New Jersey has been called Scullito for a judicial philosophy akin to that of Justice Antonin Scalia, whom the Texas governor has praised. End quote. So, gee, why would the cons be so hysterical? Why should they be so worried about this phrase Scullito when, that they would accuse anybody who uses it of being racist when for 5 years the media has been calling him Scullito, and apparently he's rather proud of the fact that his judicial philosophy is just like Scalia. And when Bush himself said, I'm going to put somebody on the court who's just like Scalia. Could it be that they don't want you to know that he's just like Scalia? And if so, why? Well, could it be that Scalia is on record as saying that Roe v. Wade should be overturned? That women shouldn't have rights in the United States? At least not with regard to reproduction? In fact, Scullito, also known as Samuel Alito, in all probability would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, and this is from the Think Progress blog. In his dissenting opinion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, Alito concurred with the majority in supporting the restrictive abortion-related measures passed by the Pennsylvania legislature in the late 1980s. Alito went further, however, saying the majority was wrong to strike down a requirement that women notify their spouses before having an abortion. The Supreme Court later rejected Alito's view of voting to reaffirm Roe v. Wade. This was in the case of Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, 1991. In other words, Alito says if a woman wants to get an abortion, she has to prove that her husband has been given informed consent, that he has been notified that she's going to get the abortion. Now, let's keep in mind the fact that one of the top four or five, I don't have the statistics in front of you, one of the top four or five groups in America at greatest risk of homicide, believe it or not, is pregnant women. That spousal rape is not an unknown thing in America, certainly is frankly not even all that uncommon. That rape with the intent of impregnating a woman is not uncommon in bad marriages where men are trying to assert power over their wives, and that this might be one of the reasons why a wife would seek an abortion. And Alito, Judge Alito, says no, a married woman, has to prove that she has given notification to her husband before she can seek an abortion. Now, how does she do that? Does she go to him and say, honey, would you please sign this paper saying that I notified you I'm getting an abortion? What if he says, no, I won't sign it? And to whom does she have to prove that she actually informed him? Does she have to call the police department? I mean, if this is a matter of law, is she breaking the law if she doesn't do it? Does she have to call a judge? Does she have to provide this to her doctor? What if she doesn't provide it to her doctor and he provides her with an abortion anyway? Has he committed a crime? Has she committed a crime? Who goes to jail? Well, I would suggest that in all probability, Judge Alito has not illuminated us on all these issues because his opinion didn't win. His opinion was struck down by the United States Supreme Court, in part because of Sandra Day O'Connor's swing vote. But now he's going to replace Sandra Day O'Connor. Now we get to the meat of the issue. I mean, this is really, I've got to tell you, I keep saying it on this program. I've been saying it for 3 years. I will continue to say it because I absolutely believe it to be true. The whole abortion thing has very little to do with abortion. There are some well-concerned, well-intentioned people who are very opposed to abortion and whom I respect because they're out there promoting things like adoption or adopting children. I have a friend in Germany who's very opposed to abortion. So what did he do? He put up posters around Germany saying, if you're pregnant and you're thinking about an abortion and you would rather have your baby, I'll help make sure that that baby gets adopted and it won't cost you a penny and we'll even provide you with prenatal care. Now, you know, that's somebody who's, you know, but a lot of the anti-abortion rhetoric, really what it's all about, has nothing to do with abortion. Just like the anti-contraception rhetoric has nothing to do with conception. And it's not just about the Catholic Church. It has to do with power. What we are looking at here is the rise again of patriarchy. They're saying, you know, this women's rights movement that started in the 1970s, well, really started in the 1700s, you know, with John Adams' wife, Abigail, writing to him when he's at the Constitutional Convention saying, don't forget the ladies. This women's rights thing, you know, well, it's time to roll that back in Mr. Alito's world, in Mr. Scalia's world. In Mr. Thomas's world, it's time to roll that back. Let's go back to Bradwell versus State, 1873, where the Supreme Court ruled that women derive their rights through their husbands and fathers. And that if a woman wants to have an abortion, she has to have the permission of her husband or father. This is Alito's position. Or at least it's the way he tried to rule. It was his dissent. I mean, he lost. But now he's going to be on the Supreme Court and he's going to win, perhaps. And who's going to go to jail? And who's going to? But I'm telling you, it's all about rolling back the rights of women. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Harpin with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yippee-i-o. Yippee-i-o. Ghost riders in the sky.
Yes, ghosts. It's Halloween. Welcome back, my friends, on this Halloween day. Your light at the end of the tunnel on Talk Radio, the Tom Harmon Radio Program, brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS for Small Dog Electronics. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, 1-800-440-8466. And John in Mount Pleasant, Michigan on the line. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, John?
Well, I just wanted to let you know I'm an Italian-American. My last name is Scalise, and I see no racial slur or ethnic slur in calling him Scalito. I think many liberal Italians are ashamed that we've got Scalia there and really don't want Alito there.
Well, John, I'm curious. You know, we know about the D word and the W word, you know, as slurs against Italian Americans, and you know, every ethnicity of America, of immigrants, well, of you know, including Native Americans, I suppose, you know, at one time or another has had a you know, some sort of a slur word associated with them. But I don't know of any that starts with an S. Do you?
No, not that I can think of off the top of my head, but there probably is one, but I can't think of it.
It's, okay, it's probably an Italian or something. I don't know who
yeah.
else. Yeah. Okay. John, thanks a lot. Good to hear from
Thank
you.
Thank
you. Appreciate
it.
Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. Lilo in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, you are.
Hey, Lilo.
Hi, Tom. I had put my call in before the subject turned to abortion. I wanted to respond to your Ayn Rand guest.
Oh, yeah.
And the remark he made about the cost of civilian casualties, that
yes.
that this cost is justified.
Yes.
And it absolutely outraged me.
Yeah, me too.
First of all, I thought the remark was very callous in regard of life. And second of all, it's rather naive, I think. It can only be made by somebody who has never experienced the consequences of war on his own soil.
Yeah, and that's true of most Americans, you know. And because it's been the last generation that remembered war on American soil died out pretty much in the 1930s, you know, and
right.
that was the generation who experienced the Civil War. And so Americans, I think, are completely out of touch with what it's like to have to be in the midst of war. I think some Americans who have served in the military in wars overseas, particularly the Vietnam War, have and now the wars in the Middle East, have some sense of what it must be like. I mean, some of them can empathize. They can understand
true,
it.
True, true.
But they're not the people who are out there saying, let's bomb them back to the Stone Age.
Yeah.
And frankly, Robert Garmong was not using that phrase. That was my phrase. But he was saying, you know, complete and total victory. And I'm saying, you know, with Germany and Japan, what happened was, and I have spent a lot of time in Japan and have many good Japanese friends and have done business in Japan and speak a little bit of Japanese. I speak a lot of German, and I lived in Germany for a year, and I have many friends in Germany, and I know people who, you know, on the whole spectrum. I mean, from old folks who still think that Hitler was a good guy, go figure. I mean, you know, it's to the average German who's horrified by what happened. And but you know, I did actually in the year that I lived there, I actually did encounter some elderly folks who were convinced that it's all, you know, it was all Hollywood movies. I mean, that cult still lives. And in any case, the point is that both Japan and Germany had monolithic cultural cults. They had the cult of worshiping the Emperor Hirohito, and they had Tojo, his guy, and they had the cult of worshiping Adolf Hitler. And when we took out those governments, we took down those cults. And so you can make an argument very, very, very effectively that by defeating those two countries militarily, we ended the cult and the country kind of woke up from a national collective insanity. But Iraq was not experiencing a national collective insanity. They hadn't invaded their neighbors. Well, they, you know, I mean, Kuwait, they got their butts kicked. I mean, you know, we kicked them right back to their borders. They weren't doing the aggression that Hitler was doing. It wasn't the rape of Nanking like Japan was doing. And so when we went in and we took out Saddam's government, what happened was, because it was not a monolithic culture and it wasn't a single cult of personality, all these tribal and ethnic and racial and not racial, religious divisions suddenly emerged, and we just didn't plan for that. And
true.
and bombing them all, you know, back to the Stone Age is not going to help.
Yeah, no, it is not. And I think part of the deliberation of whether or not to go to a war should be the civilian population.
Yeah.
Because, as you can tell from my accent, I did grow up with the consequences of war, the direct consequences of war.
In which
Although
country?
I came from Germany originally, but I was born long after the war, and I still suffered the consequences of a war I would hopefully not have agreed with.
Oh, these go on for generations.
It goes on for generations. So to make a casual remark like that is, it's just, I cannot possibly hold life as cheaply as that,
yeah,
and not consider the effect of the a war has on the civilian population, half of which may not have agreed to fighting this war or to supporting, in the Iraq case, Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, very good point, Lilo. Thank you very much for making it and for making it eloquently. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. I mean, this is it's just the clear, real bottom line here is that it was easy. It was easy to have a military victory over Saddam. We knew in advance. Nobody in their right mind, nobody in the world thought it was going to be a tough thing to defeat a government whose air force had been blown into smithereens. He had no air force. Who had been, you know, essentially starved for 7 years. It was run by a dysfunctional autocrat, a dysfunctional dictator who was siphoning off the wealth to himself, and his army was mostly 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds in rags. I mean, nobody in their right mind thought we couldn't defeat Saddam's army and take out Saddam. Question is, what do you do then? And apparently nobody in the Bush administration thought about that. And that's where, you know, Bush Sr. at least pulled together a coalition of countries, including Arab countries, to have something to do with this. And they were saying, as Mubarak said, yeah, you take out Saddam, you're going to have 1,000 bin Ladens. And Mubarak of Egypt, the president of Egypt, was right. And now we're suffering the consequences of it. 57 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. By the way, greetings to our folks at KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska, our newest affiliate, carrying our program today for the first time. And great to be on there, and hi to Rich and everybody else at KUDO. Thanks for putting us on the air in Anchorage. It's great to be on the air in Alaska. It is time for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, but this being Halloween, I figured we'd do slightly different theme music. You know, sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes you think you know everything, and sometimes you're just really wrong. And is it possible that by just looking at somebody's face, you can know what's going on with them? Rose Rosetree is a face reader, America's leading face reader, in fact, aura reader and empath. Her website is rose-rosetree.com. And Rose, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hi, Tom. I am incredibly excited to be on the show with my heroes.
Oh, well, thank you. Heroes?
Mm-hmm.
I'm flattered. We're flattered.
Well, it's true. I do lots of radio interviews, and I don't get excited like this, but my heart is going thumpity, thump, thump, thump.
Well, that's because there's zillions.
Here we are. I don't usually sound so excited and even a little nervous, but
well, we're so pleased to have you here, Rose, and don't even think about those millions of people who are staring at their radios going, what did she say? Now, when you look at a picture of George Bush's face, or when you look at George Bush's face, what does it tell you? What can you read from George Bush's face? Now, and let me just, before I ask you this, I have seen, I don't know if you've seen the cover of, I believe it's David Corn's book, Cruel and Unusual. Have you seen that? There's a biography of Bush called Cruel and Unusual.
No, I haven't.
You may have to go onto Amazon to track it out, but there's this one picture of him where he just has this just frightening look on his face. You know, and then there are pictures like I just over the weekend I was in Michigan at my parents' house, and my dad has a picture of George Bush hanging on the wall in the living room, and you know, with a quite friendly look on his face. How do you tell the difference? You know, how can you read somebody's face when, you know, in one picture there's a snarl and in another one there's a smile? And what do you see in all of those different Bush pictures out there?
Well, you see, when you're a face reader and not just an expression reader, every part of the face is meaningful. Ears, cheeks, noses, it's all full of data.
So it's like reading a palm. It doesn't matter if somebody scribbled notes on it. You can still read the palm.
best analogy. By the way, I hope you won't be appalled when I tell you that your producer sent me your photo and urged me to comment on you first.
I'm appalled.
Oh, does that mean I can do it or not?
I, at my risk, I say, sure, at my peril here. Go
okay.
for it.
Well, let me point out, and it's really good for perspective, before I read really unusual specimens of humanity like Mr. Bush, that this is a loving system of face reading, and generally what comes out is very positive. There's a talent that goes in each bit of face data, and there's a related challenge that somebody may or may not have overcome. So usually people do not cringe when I read their faces. Let me start off by talking about your passion power style.
Okay.
Did you ever notice that your forehead is wider than your cheeks, especially on the right side of your face?
No.
Well, see, this is part of the facial literacy that many of us haven't acquired because we didn't know there was any reason to have it.
Okay.
This is about being inwardly intense, where I think when you have a passion for a cause or an idea, you will go after it, and obstacles that would deter other people, you just brush them right off, and you go smashing ahead. So you're going to accomplish more in your life than most people would.
That's it. You can tell that from my face because I've smashed into so many walls. Is that it?
Oh, well, no.
He's banged his head against the wall. That's okay. All right.
The potential challenge with that is being impatient.
Yeah, well, that's a big one for me. Rose, you're spot on. What do you see in I'm curious about some of the folks who are running our country because have the potential to really, I mean, I'm not going to impact people's lives beyond maybe giving them something to think or talk about, but George W. Bush has the ability to destroy your Social Security or improve it. I mean, you know, what do you see in his face?
Here's the deal. First of all, if we can go back a little, remember when he was running for president? And
in 2000,
himself?
You mean? In 2000, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
The first time.
Right.
The first time he stole the election.
Yeah.
And he built himself as a compassionate conservative.
Right.
There are 8 different bits of data on the face that show different qualities of compassion, and he doesn't have a single one of them.
Oh, my goodness.
That tells you something right there. It's like how his dad built himself, but he talked about a kinder, gentler nation, or at least Peggy Noonan, his speechwriter, developed that idea.
Right.
And there is nothing on that man's face about kindness or gentleness.
Well, what is that? I always thought of George Sr. as being kind of the embodiment of the Ivy League Connecticut patrician. And certainly his father was that. In Bush the Elder, am I accurately guessing his personality?
Well, you know, I don't really read for who's a patrician. But I look at something on the older George, like his having what the Chinese physiognomists call a blade mouth. It's a mouth where it's both long and the lower lip curls, kind of like a scimitar.
Mm-hmm.
And for 5,000 years, face readers have said this is the mouth embodiment of cruelty.
Hmm.
Now, I would call it the potential challenge in my system of face reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say that the talent that goes with it is the ability to dispatch one's enemies with uncommon verbal effectiveness or just administrative effectiveness. But... Yeah. The challenge is being cruel either to other people or oneself. And, you know, you be the judge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
what that man did.
You know, Bush Sr. certainly climbed the ladder, and he climbed the ladder much on his own efforts as opposed to his son, who sort of had the ladder imposed on him.
Oh, George W. is an extraordinary person in that respect. I have to say that when he stole the election, the impact on me was way beyond September 11th. That was a tiny blip compared to having somebody with his face and especially his aura get into the White House.
Because?
Well, because the thing about George W. is that when he was back in Yale, I've read his photo from then. At that point, it's pretty clear from his aura that he was, what's that kind of liar who just loves lying all the time, a pathological liar?
Right.
He was that. But he also had a lot going for him. He had intelligence. He had a kind of charm. But he clearly, from his aura, beyond that admissions picture, was involved in drugs, and they blasted a hole in him.
Mm.
And I have maintained all the way through that he is somebody who can barely think. His aura is so messed up.
Well, I've had
his presence is so tiny.
I've had so many alcoholics or recovering alcoholics call into the program and say, And I'm not a member of AA and can't, you know, I can't claim to be part of that fraternity or have those insights, but and suggest that George is actually what they refer to as a dry drunk, an untreated alcoholic, that he's and that he's still, and there actually is a, I forget the name for it. It's one of those hyphenated names after two physicians of the alcoholic syndrome, where you actually have alcoholic brain damage.
Yeah, well, I think there's also cocaine-related kind of damage in him. And
well, he did serve 90 days of community service for cocaine arrest back in the 70s, so there is that.
So, you know, when I write books like Aura Readings to All Your Senses and The Power of Face Reading, and I teach people how to do this, I'll tell you, one agenda is just because it's so much fun, and because usually you find things that are uplifting, but a real strong passion that I have as well is that I'm convinced that if more Americans would simply read people deeper, people like W would never even be nominated by their parties. Because you know what? There are plenty of people who could do a much better job who are actually honest.
For we're talking with Rose Rosetree, by the way, America's leading face reader. Your website, rose-rosetree.com. And Rose, we just have 1 minute left. Some of our other leaders, any points that pop out for you?
Yeah, definitely. In general, on people, crookedness isn't a big deal, but on high-level politicians, differences between left and right, if they grow and grow and grow, this gives you nuance to the term crooked politician. And if you check out Scooter Libby, or you check out Dick Cheney or Karl Rove, or the extraordinary changes to George W. Bush's face with crookedness since they've been in the White House,
they're all very asymmetrical.
Appalled how crooked they are, and those forms of crookedness all mean something, and it's not good.
Yeah, Cheney always seems to speak out of one side of his mouth. I mean, physically, literally.
That's right. He's got both mouth pulls and higher mouth.
Now, couldn't that just be a sign of a small? Couldn't that just be a sign of a small stroke?
No.
No. Okay. This is actually a symptom of character, in your opinion.
Well, it is, and you can learn to read faces and see that alphabet. And again, usually it's inspiring, but if somebody uses free will to mess up life, that's going to show in the face as well.
Remarkable. Okay, well, thank you. Our Halloween Everything You Know Is Wrong insight from Rose Rosetree, rose-rosetree.com, America's leading face reader and aura reader and empath. Rose, thanks so much for being with us.
My honor.
It was our pleasure to have you. 16 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call?
And welcome back. Happy Halloween, my friends.
And it don't look good.
Who you gonna call? We need an exorcism, you know? In Washington, D.C., it's time for an exorcism. That's what we need to do. We need to call in an exorcist. Maybe Victoria Jones knows of a good one. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Yeah, well, the only good one I know of actually got killed in the movie The Exorcist, didn't he? Which was set in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I never saw the movie. Not a fan of horror films.
Oh, I'm a huge, unashamed now. I'm out of the closet fan. Yeah, set in Washington, D.C.
You love horror movies, huh?
I love horror movies, and I decided eventually I had to come out because
amazing. I got, you know, when I was a kid, Old Yeller was the first wound, and then Fly came along when I was like 12 or 13, and it so horrified me, so scared me that I just, that's it. I'm not doing that. I don't like going to movies where I cry or where I scream. I just don't like it.
You couldn't pay me money to see Old Yeller. I've never seen it, and I never will.
Yeah, well, because everybody you know of my generation tells you how badly scarred they were by it, right?
It's just everybody weeps.
Yeah, yeah. I did for weeks.
I don't go there to weep.
I did for weeks, yeah. Anyhow, enough of our movie reviews for the day. By the way, I hear that Good Night and Good Luck is a mind-bogglingly good movie. Louise and I are going
to
try and get out and see it this week.
Looking forward very much to this, yeah.
So, speaking of, McCarthyite witch hunts in Washington, D.C. and whatnot, the conservatives now are saying that if you call Alito Scalito, you are being anti-Italian racist.
Yeah, I saw that online earlier today, and I've been trying not to say it since, because I thought, okay, well, if I am being racist, let's not be. And then I've been thinking it through that, what is racist about this?
There is nothing racist about it whatsoever. In fact, an Italian-American called into our program a little earlier and confirmed that there is a D word and a W word which are used in a racist way to describe Italian-Americans and have been, over time.
Right.
But no S words. No S words. None at all. And
quite extraordinary.
Yeah, in fact, it was in 2000, 5 years ago, five full years ago, that the Houston Chronicle said in an article about George W. Bush, when he was governor of Texas, and his appreciation of Judge Alito, Judge Samuel Alito, Jr., 50, of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, Alito of Newark, New Jersey, has been called Scalito for a judicial philosophy akin to that of Justice Antonin Scalia, whom the Texas governor has praised, end quote. So apparently 5 years ago, George W. Bush was calling him Scalito.
You know, I wonder if this is the beginning of trying to portray him as a minority.
Well, they're trying to portray him as anything other than Scalia, because Americans have figured out that if you have more Scalias on the bench, you're going to have more people. You're going to be, the police are going to be able to arrest you without a charge. They're going to be able to hold you as long as they want without you ever seeing a court. They're going to be able to deport you to countries that, where you could be tortured, even if you're an American citizen. If you're a woman, you won't be able to get an abortion. If you're a woman, at least you'll have to have your husband's permission, even to get birth control. I mean, you know, it's the war. Or, I guess the largest part of this, really, is the war on women that these guys are engaged in. It's the rise of patriarchy.
I don't think that young women below 30 have any idea what this means. They just do not get it.
No.
They simply are not aware of how serious some of this stuff is. And, it's up to the Democrats. If the Democrats can get it across to the American people that this is somebody who might do some of those things or all of those things, then maybe the American people have a chance of him not being put on the court. But if it's up to the Democrats to carry the ball.
Well, or God forbid, it may be that we have to live through another cycle of this. I mean, I think that Bush trying to cut back on people's Social Security caused a whole lot of people on Social Security to wake up and say, hey, wait a minute. And all of a sudden he's had to back off on that. I remember, there was a girl in my high school class who died of a botched abortion. I mean, I wasn't close to her. I didn't know her particularly well, but she was there one day and wasn't the next. And she had died of an infection, I believe, that was associated with an abortion because it was illegal then. I mean, this was 1966 or 67. And, the kids of today, or people probably under 30, whatever the age it would be, just don't remember that time. They don't remember what it was like. And it may take the criminalization of abortion to wake them up enough that they get politically active and they throw these bums out and they change things.
And also perhaps, real restrictions on birth control. I think people will be very surprised at the lack of privacy that they might be going to see.
Yeah. Well, and we're already seeing. I mean, there are pharmacies across America right now that will not pass out Plan B, which is a birth control pill, even for women who've been raped. You know, it's a birth control pill that only works in the first 3 days after intercourse to prevent conception.
Who is a single woman supposed to get the permission from?
Well, that's a good question. Judge Alito didn't elaborate on that when he ruled, or he tried to rule. When he was in the minority, he lost, but he tried to rule that a woman has to have, it wasn't permission, has to have informed her husband that she's getting an abortion. And
well,
my
don't...
question is, what if the husband says, you want me to sign a form saying that you've informed me? I'm not going to sign it.
Exactly.
And then what, do the police show up? I mean, to what extent? These conservatives, they're all about putting the power of government and police in our bedrooms and in our homes. And I'm over it.
I'm with you, my friend.
Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Victoria. Good hearing from
you
today.
Bye-bye.
Keep up the great work. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Happy Halloween, my friends. Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Here at our program brought to you today by EcoWine, 1-888-ECOWINE, the organic wine company, ecowine.com, 1-888-ECOWINE. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. Yes, our caught you doing something right alert for the day. John Conyers. John Conyers has directed his committee staff to conduct a full and comprehensive investigation into Treasongate, among other things. John Conyers, Congressman John Conyers, Jr., ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee, issued the following statement regarding Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald's decisions to indict Scooter Libby. He said, "The indictments represent the beginning, but not the end of the process of finally holding the Bush administration accountable for its conduct in foisting a preemptive war on this country. The prosecutor has performed his job in pursuing this case vigorously and fairly. However, the charges really beg the larger question, what did the president and vice president know about these and related matters, and when did they know it? I believe it is imperative that Congress pursue these questions and determine how these charges fit into the entire web of deception, manipulation, and obfuscation laid bare by the Downing Street Minutes and Treasongate. As a result, I have directed my staff to conduct a comprehensive investigation and review of the facts concerning not only alleged efforts to misuse the White House to out a CIA operative, but misinformation concerning the run-up to the Iraq War and all legal violations and breaches of trust by this administration concerning the war." End of quote. John Conyers. Isn't that remarkable? Absolutely remarkable. John Conyers. So and good on him. Well said, John Conyers. Much appreciated. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466. We have now Sam Alito. I'm stuck in that for a brief window of time. You know, the summer of '68. Part of the summer of '68, I lived in San Francisco, and my recollection is that a guy named Joe Alioto was the mayor there. I could be wrong, but in any case, so I mix these things up. Samuel Alito has been nominated, and the People for the American Way has some very strong thoughts about this, along with others. If you go back, as Think Progress folks are reporting, Nina Totenberg, for example, of NPR, on NPR's Morning Edition. Now, legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, no radical herself. Nina Totenberg has said, Stephen Inskeep question, how high are the stakes now for this nomination to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court? Nina Totenberg, well, if Judge Alito is confirmed, the court will move dramatically to the right. There are conservatives who are less conservative than he, and I guess one could have said that with Harriet Myers you didn't know, so liberals could hope that she would be a little more to the left. There's no question where he is. He's been on the court for 15 years. There's an established record, much more of a record, I might note, than John Roberts had on the court. And it's going to show a very, very conservative judge. The SaveTheCourt.org website, put on by People for the American Way, headline, Bush puts demands of right, above interests of Americans with high court nomination of right-wing activist Alito. PFAW will wage massive national effort to defeat nominee who would dramatically shift the balance of the court. And they said that right-wingers vetoed Myers because she failed their ideological litmus test with Judge Alito. President Bush has obediently picked a nominee who passes that test with flying colors. This is from Ralph Neese, president of People for the American Way. He said, we had hoped President Bush would nominate someone with a commitment to protecting America's rights and freedoms. That's what the American people want. It's what they deserve. Unfortunately, with Judge Alito, that's not what President Bush has given us. He has chosen to divide Americans with a nominee guaranteed to cause a bitter fight. He says, replacing a mainstream conservative like Justice O'Connor with a far-right activist like Samuel Alito would threaten Americans' rights and legal protections for decades. It sounds kind of rhetorical. What are some of the basic concerns? Well, for example, Alito is a leader of the radical far-right movement to prevent the federal government from enforcing civil rights protections and otherwise acting on behalf of the common good. According to one of Alito's opinions, Congress had no authority to require state employers to comply with the Family and Medical Leave Act through payment of damages when they violate the law, a ruling that was repudiated by the Supreme Court. The late Chief Justice Rehnquist, a fellow ultra-conservative, wrote that court's opinion. Alito also dissented from a ruling by the Third Circuit that Congress has the power under the Commerce Clause to restrict the transfer and possession of machine guns at gun shows. So, you know, you have the right to have a machine gun. You don't have the right to have an abortion. You don't have the right to be paid if, you know, somebody, a member of your family falls ill and you have to take some time off work. Alito's record shows an alarming trend. Writes SaveTheCourt.org, an alarming trend towards standing against protections for workers. In a number of dissenting opinions, Alito has taken positions that, if adopted, would have made it difficult for victims of race and sex discrimination to prove their case. In one case involving claims of race discrimination, the court majority sharply criticized Alito's dissent, stating that his position would immunize an employer from the reach of Title VII in certain circumstances. Alito wants the government to be able to interfere in personal decisions on reproductive rights. This is the Pennsylvania law that says that basically that women have to notify their husbands before they go to get an abortion. It raises a lot of questions. How do you prove that the husband has been notified? Does he have to consent? What if he refuses to accept notification? Oh, my. In one case that came before Alito, this is about racial discrimination and capital punishment. In one case that came before Alito, an African-American had been convicted of felony murder and sentenced to death by an all-white jury from which black voters had, or jurors had been impermissibly struck. In other words, when they were doing the jury selection, the prosecutor simply said, every black juror, every potential black juror, we're not going to have any. It's going to be an all-white jury. Alito cast the deciding vote and wrote the majority opinion in a 2-1 ruling rejecting the defendant's claim. The full Third Circuit reversed his ruling, and the majority specifically criticized him for having compared statistical evidence about the prosecution's exclusion of blacks from juries in capital cases to an explanation of why a disproportionate number of recent U.S. presidents have been left-handed. According to the majority, quote, to suggest any comparability to the striking of jurors based on their race is to minimize the history of discrimination against prospective black jurors and black defendants, end quote. He tried to say that kicking somebody off a jury because they happen to be black, when a black defendant is at trial with a white victim, that knocking all the black jurors off the jury is statistically, you know, in the same realm as the number of left-handed presidents of the United States we've had. I mean, it is pretty amazing. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning. This guy affects me personally.
How so?
In 1998, I was riding a motorcycle, and I hit a semi-truck head-on.
Ouch.
That I'm on this planet is a miracle. I spent a long time in the hospital. But I paid for that accident with my left torso. I can't use it. I've lost my diaphragm. I've lost a lot of stuff inside my body. Hmm. And it affects me. And it also may affect my ability to get a job.
Sure.
I'm worried that if I go in for an interview that I won't get a job because of the extent of my disabilities. I'm a writer. I have the use of one hand. This affects me personally. So if I go in for a job and I'm qualified for the job, I've got the experience and I can demonstrate it, and yet I don't get hired, I always wonder if it was because of my disability. And this guy will let that I won't be able to bring a case, Tom. I won't be
right.
able to fight this. I'll be out of a job.
What we the people have decided is that people, because of their disabilities, because of their religion, because of their race, because of their gender, cannot be discriminated against. And Scalia and Thomas and Alito are of the opinion that the federal government has no business enforcing anti-discrimination laws, basically.
And so this hits me personally. What can I do?
Yeah.
I've already called my senators today. I've already told them what I've told you.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the most we can do is contact our senators and this stuff is going to come out. You know what's happening, Scott, is that Americans are figuring out that Bush is, and not just Bush, that Bush, DeLay, Frist, that this whole cabal, they don't represent America. They don't even represent traditionally the Republican Party. They certainly don't represent traditional conservatives. They are Reichwingers. They represent an extremism that we haven't seen in this country for a century.
And really supporting the corporations against people like me and you all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Activist judges on the right rewriting law against what the original intent was. Tom, I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm not going to just call my senators. I'm writing a letter from what I've told you and what I told my senators. I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to ask all of my friends.
That's important, Scott. That's important. And also, you know, one of the things that I've heard recently is that when you send a letter to a senator in Washington, D.C., that it may take months to get there because they're screening everything for anthrax. Send it to their local office.
Thank you.
Send your letters to your senator's local offices. And a letter has 10 times the impact of a phone call, and a phone call has 1,000 times the impact of an email. So, you know, there you go. That's the order.
I think the Dems are going to filibuster this time, Tom.
I sure hope so, Scott. I sure hope so. I mean, this guy is as far to the right as you can get. We shouldn't be surprised, but, you know, here it is. Scott, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Good luck. And 45 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Another one bites the dust.
And welcome back. Happy Halloween. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466 all across the United States. Let's not forget, you'll recall a week ago, I suggested that the day after the indictments come down, actually I think I originally said minutes after, but you know, practically speaking, the day after the indictments come down, you are going to see a nominee for the Supreme Court. And guess what? The indictments come down at the end of last week, and bang, first thing Monday morning, a radical appointment to the Supreme Court. But let's not forget about the real issues that brought this thing about. Juan Williams, NPR's Juan Williams on Fox News, trying to get back to the real issues, and Brett Hume's telling him he should be hosed down. Yeah.
In the posture of trying to smear a critic of that justification, I think it's pretty revealing and I think pretty damaging to the Bush White House. And I think they're going to have to rebuild a sense of trust with the American people. And that's why when Britt asked this question about, why did he have to lie? He felt the need to lie, if he did lie, but by all indications he's going to say, I didn't remember it quite the way this person remembered and all the like. That's not very strong in my book, and I think Fitzgerald did a terrific job on Friday. But the reason he felt the need was to make it clear that he was not involved in what really was a conspiracy to defame Joe Wilson.
Well, Juan, somebody needs to hose you down.
Yeah, somebody needs to hose you down. Amazing. Forgive the moments of dead air there. I had this thing in queue, and it was sounding in my headphones like it was going out just fine, but it wasn't, so... that was Juan Williams basically talking about that. Tom in Wyoming, Michigan on the line. Our number 1-866-440-8466. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's about the Scalito thing.
Yeah.
You know, Republicans are brilliant at this, and Democrats have got to learn how to do it. You know,
the Republicans are in a position to control the agenda, so, you know.
Well, I mean, as far as manipulating the media, though.
Yeah.
They do something radical. They put it, and then they come out and just distract everybody with something ridiculous like the Scalito thing and put it in the us against them terms. And they play on people's bigotries and fears.
Yeah.
And now this will be the headlines in the papers and be on all the news channels. This is what everybody's going to talk about instead of this guy's record.
Yeah. And not just this guy's record, but also the many other scandals of this administration, the fact that George W. Bush is trying to destroy Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, the entire social safety net in the United States, that that poverty is on the increase, that the top 0.1% of Americans are exploding in wealth, the top 1% increasing in wealth, top 1% owning more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans. I mean, it's just None of that stuff is going to be on the front page. What's going to be on the front page is, you know, right-winger nominated for the Supreme Court. Bush is a divider, not a uniter.
Absolutely.
First class.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I just wish that once in a while somebody on the left would just actually say that on TV, you know?
Yeah, well, I just said it on the radio. I hope that's good enough for you, Tom. Florence in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Florence, what's up?
Oh, hi. I called to tell you that I'm an Italian-American with a last name, maiden name of Botticelli.
Uh-huh.
And I have no problems with Scalito.
So you don't think it's an ethnic slur to call Alito Scalito?
Absolutely not. I thought whoever used it was clever because he's probably an adoptee of Scalia's anyway.
Yeah, well, apparently it goes back a long way because here you have back, in 2000, 5 years ago, we have this in the Houston Chronicle. Judge Samuel Alito Jr., 50, of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of New Jersey, has been called Scalito for a judicial philosophy akin to that of Justice Antonin Scalia, for whom the Texas governor, that would be George W. Bush, has praised. And this is an article 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
5 years ago in Texas.
Okay, I'll have to look that up.
And the Houston Chronicle.
I also wanted to suggest that I think there was a big meeting at the White House prior to the indictments coming out, and I think there was a meeting where they drew straws to who was going to be the fall guy for this indictment thing. And I think it was Libby because George couldn't afford to have Rove go.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fall guys, by the way, in the beginning of the next hour, we're going to have Janice Karpinski with us live here in the studio.
I know.
She has.
I've heard her. I heard her on Democracy Now.
Yeah, been the victim.
But anyway, that's my opinion of what happened prior to Fitzgerald's big announcement.
So you
and
think?
I wouldn't be surprised if he's part of it.
You think Libby is falling on his sword intentionally?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, to save Rove because George can't do without Rove.
Yeah. Well,
Neither can Cheney, by the way.
I suspect Libby has been more thrown to the wolves. Clearly, in my mind, this thing goes right to Cheney. You know, Cheney
goes right to the president.
And in fact, the indictment itself.
That little boy we call a president.
Yeah, the indictment itself talks about George W. Bush. I mean, you go back and look at the indictment, but
okay. But anyway, amazing.
Thanks a lot, Florence. Good to hear from you. Yeah, bye now. It's the indictment. Libby participated in discussions in the office of the vice. I'm quoting from the indictment. Participated in discussions in the office of the vice president concerning how to respond. That Walter Pincus' story in the Washington Post, suggesting that the Bush administration had lied about bad intelligence on uranium prior to the war. I mean, here, you know, it's like, what more do you need? He's sitting in the White House. He's talking to Dick Cheney. He's getting this information. And Bush out there basically, you know, lying us into this war. And, you know, with the clear, I mean, just clear.
Facing clear evidence of peril. We cannot wait for the final proof. The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
I mean, you know, and in my mind, the question is, who started this? You know, was it Bush or was it Cheney? And when? And who's going to hold them accountable? And frankly, unless we get Democrats in office in 2006, particularly in the House of Representatives, I have this horrible feeling nobody's going to hold them accountable. But we'll see. Fitzgerald may surprise us. He may surprise us, and this may continue in ways that nobody could have expected. Because clearly, clearly, crimes have been committed here. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and streaming from the website of AirAmericaRadio.com. Welcome back to our program, 6.5 minutes past the hour. And Janice Karpinski is with me. Janice?
Yes, indeed.
Or Ms. Karpinski, you're not. You don't have a military title now that you use.
No, so. But I prefer Janice. That's
Janice,
fine.
Okay. It is an honor to have you in the studio here.
Pleased to be
with
here.
Us. It's you have stood up to a withering level of attack that I think few people could probably even imagine. And you've done it with fortitude and with honor, and I you're one of my heroes.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I'm very pleased to be here with you. A couple of the things in your book. You have a new book out. It's called One Woman's Army, which is available in bookstores everywhere,
right?
Online as well. Is there a website for it, by the way?
Not yet.
Okay. But, Amazon.com or whatever, you can check it out. One Woman's Army, the commanding general of Abu Ghraib tells her story. This by Janice Karpinski. Tell us about Ricardo Sanchez.
From the time that I first met him, when we were, we knew that we would be relocating to Iraq, to Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to talk to me directly. I was accompanied by my predecessor, the former commander of the 800th Military Police Brigade.
Now, he was doing the investigation, right?
General Sanchez,
right.
Directed the investigation, right, when all of this happened.
Right.
But the person who was investigating was actually a friend of his. So you lose this impartiality right from the jump.
Yeah.
And he was a two-star, General Taguba.
Mm-hmm.
He was directed to go up and find out from General Sanchez what he wanted him to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And General Sanchez did not direct General Taguba to do an investigation about how these photographs were possible.
Mm-hmm.
He directed him to do an investigation to find out what was wrong with Janice Karpinski and the 800th MP Brigade.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. And
now, I think the most folks, certainly the spin that the administration and the military put out there is that Janice Karpinski was in charge of Abu Ghraib prison, that you were in charge of, and that, Lindy England and all these folks worked for you, and that it's all your fault, basically. That's the meme that they've tried to install in people's minds. How is that not true?
Well, from the beginning, that was the intent. The spokesperson for General Sanchez, Brigadier General Kimmett, used only one person's name in connection with the photographs when they were first released in April of 2004, and that was my name. General Karpinski was in charge, General Karpinski's soldiers, General Karpinski, the 800th MP Brigade. But when I tried to get access to these soldiers, when I first heard about the investigation, and that would have been in January of 2004,
mm-hmm,
I was told specifically I had no right or authorization to speak to any of those soldiers because they didn't work for me. So somewhere between January and April, when the photographs were released, the spin or the decision was made that, wait, we can say that General Karpinski was in charge and this was her leadership failures and these were 7 soldiers that were simply out of control on the night shift.
Mm-hmm.
And my
But you say they didn't work for you?
Well, that's what I was told. Now, I would tell you that I will never abandon soldiers who worked for me in any capacity.
Right.
And these soldiers were assigned to a company that was part of a battalion that was subordinate to my brigade.
You were technically at the top of their chain of command.
That's correct. But in this particular situation, what they wanted people to believe was I should have been supervising these privates and private first class and specialists.
Which is not something generals usually do.
Absolutely. I'm in charge of the brigade. I had 17 prison facilities. What they did not report.
So you were an administrator.
Correct.
By and large.
I was a commander.
Right.
And I was responsible for these 3,400 soldiers and over 40,000 prisoners in the course of the time we were there.
Pardon my interrupting. You said what they did not report.
What they did not report was that in September of 2003,
mm-hmm,
during General Miller's visit, General Miller was the commander from Guantanamo Bay. He was sent to Iraq to help the military intelligence interrogators do a better job of getting actionable intelligence from their interrogations. From September of 2003, cell block 1A and 1B was under the control of the commander of the Military Intelligence Brigade. So we have interrogations taking place at a detention facility, but they were not taking place in cell block 1A or B. They were just higher value detainees that were being held in those cell blocks. two specially constructed interrogation facilities on the grounds of Abu Ghraib were specifically for the purpose of interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just simply interview rooms is what they appeared like.
Right.
So in November of 2003, at the direction of General Sanchez, by official order, command of Abu Ghraib was transferred from Janice Karpinski to Tom Pappas, who was the commander of the Military Intelligence Brigade. That wasn't reported.
So Lindy England and, you know, I mean, all these names that everybody's familiar with, they were not working for you. They were working for him.
They were. They were taking instructions from him, from these contract interrogators, from people who were now focused on interrogation operations.
Then why did the, if this is the case, and you know, I'm no reason not to believe you, and there's a documentary trail in your book. I mean, this is pretty irrefutable. If this is the case, why you? Why did they decide to step on Janice Karpinski?
Well, I used the expression, I checked a lot of blocks. I was a reservist, and these soldiers were National Guard and Reserve soldiers that were assigned to the 800th MP Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
This supported this direction that the Pentagon wanted to enforce, that Reserve and National Guard soldiers were not as competent. I didn't tell the Secretary of Defense to respond to a National Guard soldier's question by saying, well, you go to war with the army that you have, not the army that you want.
Right.
That somehow justified not giving them the right equipment.
Yeah.
But that was the real feeling at the Pentagon. And it did filter down to all of us.
Wait a minute. The real feeling at the Pentagon was sort of, you know, hey, you know, if the soldiers on the ground don't like it, tough.
Exactly. And if they're Reserve and National Guard soldiers, you know, we give them the leftovers anyway. They're second class compared to the active component soldiers.
Right. So you were the commander of the second class bunch.
Correct.
And so when it came time to assign blame to somebody,
they said, we'll blame them. They're going to go back to their civilian jobs, their civilian lives, and we'll move ahead with this.
Right.
As naive and as ridiculous as that sounds, even saying it, that's what, in fact, was happening.
So Jeffrey Miller, General Jeffrey Miller, comes to Iraq and Abu Ghraib from Guantanamo Bay,
right,
where he has been supervising the interrogation of and not just the interrogation, but he's been running that show down there where there's, now we know, some fairly brutal interrogation techniques had been, I don't want to say pioneered, because this stuff goes back to probably the 10th century B.C., but some pretty brutal stuff was going on down there. And all of a sudden, these same types of interrogation techniques start appearing at Abu Ghraib,
right,
in the prison that you were responsible for overall as part of your command. To what extent has he ever been held accountable for these kinds of abuses?
Well, when he testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee, and I'm paraphrasing now, but I'm not changing the content,
mm-hmm,
he said, in response to several questions, that he was simply sent there to assist. He was never assigned to Iraq, so he didn't have command authority. He could not have directed actions, specific actions. However, he used the expression, while he was there, that he was going to Gitmo-ize the operation at Abu Ghraib. He wanted Abu Ghraib to be the interrogation center for Iraq. And even though he denied to the Senate Armed Services Committee ever using that expression, it is in fact what he did.
Mm-hmm.
He sent his best contract interrogators, and they brought those techniques with them that had been tested and used down at Guantanamo Bay.
Now, were these techniques that were actually effective at getting intelligence, do you think?
There's no reason to believe that they get any intelligence from the people that they were using these techniques with.
Really?
None.
Because
the intelligence that led to the capture of Saddam Hussein, for example,
mm-hmm,
was not developed at Abu Ghraib.
Yeah.
The majority of the people that they were holding as security detainees at Abu Ghraib were in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were innocent.
Don't you generally, in fact, when you're interrogating somebody, want to create kind of a Stockholm syndrome thing? You want them to identify with you. You want to unbrainwash them and get them on your side rather than terrify them.
Well, I'm not in the lane of interrogations, but
mm-hmm,
there have been great studies done, and people with far more experience in interrogation than any of those people had would say exactly that you have to respect a person in order to get the information that you want back from them.
If it's going to be meaningful.
If it's going to,
yeah,
be accurate and meaningful.
Otherwise, it's, I'll tell you anything you want to know, just stop pulling my fingernails out.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, it's absolutely remarkable. We're talking with Janice Karpinski, the author of One Woman's Army. The commanding general of Abu Ghraib tells tells her story. Miramax Books. Can you stick around for a few minutes? I have a couple more questions I'd like to ask you.
Sure.
Do you have another 15 minutes?
Absolutely.
We can spend a little more time on this. I'm particularly interested in stacks of money and some of these photos and what might still be coming out that hasn't come out yet. Janet Karpinski in the studio with us. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. Yes, there are Halloween theme music. We have got the strangest bumper music today. Happy Halloween. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, from behind the good old stainless steel working class microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. And Janice Karpinski is with me here in the studio. She's the author of One Woman's Army, The Commanding General of Abu Ghraib Tells Her Story. And we were just talking about the loss of how these little incremental changes lead to great big consequences, as it were. And you were talking about people being treated as less than human and the consequences of that you saw in Iraq. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, you know, soldiers are arriving in Iraq first time, sometime many of them that had ever been in the Middle East before. They weren't didn't participate in the first Gulf War, so they're overwhelmed by the conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And fearlessly, soldiers assigned to the 800th MP Brigade, in all of the facilities they were running, they saw these conditions. They saw how austere everything was. They asked, you know, why is all this garbage in the streets? Did we do that, or was it always like this? And trying to establish how different it is living there in Iraq, or was this a result of the war? But they did everything they could to make life more acceptable, as austere as the conditions were. So if they were rationed water and they got two bottles, they often shared one bottle with the prisoners, or they gave it to the prisoners, because the soldiers know the right things to do.
Well, the bottom line is, you know, we're all human beings, and Americans do have kind of a tradition of being caring people. I mean, it's not. It's easy as an American to say Americans are like that. I think every country would say, you know, our country has a tradition of being caring because it's intrinsic to human nature.
Except, you know, that's interesting because I spoke to some people that were some Iraqis trying to sort this out and
sure, they're trying to figure out who we are
exactly and learn from them. And these were individuals who lived in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to understand their mindset when it came to, like I asked them, for example, we're trying to do this recruiting for Iraqi prison guards. We want them to come back to work to participate in this rebuilding process. And I asked, would this be a good job? And one of the men said, no, this would not be a good job.
Mm.
Why not? Because these are bad people. And we think that you're treating the prisoners too well. We think, you know, they should be treated like prisoners. So that's kind of the idea of the mindset. Now, you would probably get a completely different response outside of Baghdad.
Sure.
Because the people that lived in Baghdad, of course, were the fair-haired children with Saddam.
Yeah.
They were.
Well, there's an old saying, and I'm paraphrasing badly, but people who have been brutalized become brutal.
And that's again, very interesting, because when I spoke to the people up in the Kurdish region and I said, why is Baghdad so resistant? Why don't they don't seem like they're eager to participate in this rebuilding? And the response immediately was because they're ashamed, because they were brutalized for so long. They kept quiet when their neighbors were having their heads blown off. They kept quiet when they heard their neighbors scream. Because under Saddam's fedaheen, it was brutal.
Sure.
And now they're ashamed to come back out and say, please forgive me for what I did before, but I want to participate in this new rebuilding effort.
Remarkable. Now, you talk about, in your book, Paul Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority and pallets of cash, mind-boggling waste. These guys were trying to... Here's my take on what they were, if I may, for a moment. Those nasty liberals, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, after World War II, went in and gave Germany and Japan constitutions that they had tried to pass, laws that they had tried to pass in the United States, unionization, universal health insurance, strong human rights, strong labor rights, things like that. And, you know, how dare they, right? And so Bremer and these ideologues, these neoconservative ideologues, in my opinion, they went into Iraq and they said, we're going to create a neoconservative Iraq. We're going to prove that this libertarian vision works. And so immediately they imposed a flat tax of 15%. Corporations could do anything they want. They threw open the borders. They allowed corporations to import other labor. They banned labor unions. They did all these, you know, they created Iraq in their image and in the belief, I believe, in the perhaps well-intentioned even belief, that it would turn into a workers' paradise. And, in fact, it was a disaster, was it not?
It was, because their objective was 90 days or less to do this wonderful stuff.
This cultural transformation.
Yes.
Well, am I correct in my analysis of their transformation?
Yes, that they really believe that here we are, we're the Americans, we're going to establish an embassy here, and we know the way.
Yeah.
So these are the things you need to do, and do them now.
Amazing.
It was.
Yeah. Can you stick around a little bit longer, perhaps even take a few phone calls?
Sure.
Our telephone number is 866-440-8466. I'm finding this just a fascinating conversation. Janice Karpinski is with us, 1-866-440-THOM. One Woman's Army is her book, The Commanding General of Abu Ghraib. Am I pronouncing it? Ghraib? I've heard that from...
They largely mispronounce it, but, you know, that's Arabic language. You have lots of different pronunciations.
Abu Ghraib. Tells her story. And the extraordinary, were they really bringing in bales of cash?
Pallets of cash, absolutely.
Pallets of cash. Any idea where this went?
Well, you know, when the audit agency did their investigation, they came up $8 billion short.
$8 billion with a B. Well, we'll get into that and more in just a moment. We're talking with, I keep wanting to say General Janet Karpinski. You are now retired. One Woman's Army, the commanding general of Abu Ghraib, tells her story. It's the Tom Hartmann Program, 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartmann.
Oh, yeah. Get out there and enjoy yourself tonight. Halloween is upon us. Did I call it Thanksgiving last time around? I didn't. Okay. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartmann here with you. Janice Karpinski is in the studio with us. A rare opportunity to speak with one of my heroes. One Woman's Army is her book. The Commanding General of Abu Ghraib tells her story. And what compelled you to write this book? Oops, sorry, there you go.
I think that a lot of damage was done to make it appear that I was an inept and incompetent leader. And I did not just decide I wanted to crawl out of a cave, volunteer to be a brigadier general, and go to war.
Mm-hmm.
I earned my promotions, and I wanted to establish credibility with readers, mm-hmm. with people who would know about this, and tell the story and be the voice for the soldiers who no longer have a voice, the ones that are, some of them are sitting in prisons, wrongly accused, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
They made mistakes, but did they design these things in the photographs? No, absolutely not. So I needed to do this.
Do you think that, for example, Lindy England should have gone through the trial and gotten the sentence that she got?
I think that Lindy England made mistakes, and she should certainly be punished, but... the sentence that she got on the second trial, I believe that, you know, they said that there was reasons for throwing the first one out.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that the plea bargain was leaked.
Mm-hmm.
People in the Pentagon did not approve of what she was going to get in terms of punishment. So all of a sudden now they're throwing that case out and making her go through it again.
Yeah.
Too long a sentence, in my opinion. For
What baffles me is the privatization of war. The idea that we are paying Halliburton contractors $150,000 a year to deliver mail and serve food, among other things, to soldiers that used to deliver their own mail and serve their own food. I actually had a mother on this program about a year ago whose son died on the Baghdad Airport Road. traveling to the airport to get his mail because there was about more or less a 1 month period there where Halliburton refused to deliver the mail because it was not, you know, it was not secure. And so the soldiers, if they wanted to get their mail, had to drive out to the airport and get it because we had privatized the delivery of the mail.
That's correct.
And privatizing the interrogation of prisoners. I don't get it. What's going on with our military? How can you have a military that's partly privatized and have it work?
Well, remember the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which has been around for a long time mm-hmm. and is reliable, applies to military personnel.
Only. Right.
Private contractors doing any number of formerly military missions are being paid, yes, exorbitant amounts of money, and the rules don't apply.
So this isn't just about, hey, let's make some friends of Dick Cheney rich. This is about let's do things in ways for which we will be unaccountable.
Correct. And that's a complete departure from what we know is correct and fair and the American way of doing things when we go to war.
Yeah.
This is authorized thievery.
You know, it in a bizarre way, and again, at the risk of sounding hyperbolic, it reminds me of how Hitler built all the death camps outside of Germany because he knew that someday something would come out about them. He was assuming he would win the war and would be a hero in history, but something would come out, and he'd be able to say, oh, those nasty Poles, look at what they did, and those nasty Dutch, look at what they did in Belsen, and the Poles or the Czechs, and, you know, and like this. And that's why none of the death camps were actually, you know, there were concentration camps in Germany, but the assembly lines were essentially privatized. They were outsourced. And we are outsourcing now interrogation and torture. And, for example, we're sending prisoners to other countries to be tortured. We were talking during the break about John McCain and this bill. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's important. It's important when you see that it was approved with an overwhelming majority, 90-9.
Now, what we're talking about here is a bill, and it was a rider to an appropriations bill that basically said, it wasn't setting new rules, that basically said that the rules that are in the Army manual and have been since World War II or before have to be followed with regard to the way that prisoners are treated.
Correct, by military personnel.
Right.
And I think that it's certainly a good bill, a good initiative, but it's a shame that we have to promote a bill to do what soldiers know is right to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're trained that way. They know the rules. They know the Geneva Conventions. And they know that they're there to protect them should any of their colleagues ever be taken prisoner.
Right. Dave in Eureka, California is on the line. Dave, you're live with Janice Karpinski.
Hey, Janice, I heard you on Democracy Now! The other day, and I definitely had the impression from that much of this came straight down from Rumsfeld. Abuse of prisoners, that is, and that you were not comfortable with it, and that may be more why you got to be selected as the fall guy. I get that impression listening to you.
Well, you know, had any of this information been provided to anybody in the 800th MP Brigade that these are the interrogation practices that are going to be used in your detention facilities, we would have objected. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after I was told that there was an ongoing investigation out at Abu Ghraib that I became aware of this signed memorandum by the Secretary of Defense authorizing interrogation practices such as we've seen, and not only in the photographs but have been reported by interrogators who have returned. I think I was, a convenient fall guy.
Hmm. Or fall girl, or whatever the fall
or woman scapegoat.
Or, yeah, scapegoat. They're a gender-neutral term. Thank you for that call, Dave. And which raises the question, you said this goes all the way to the top. Don Rumsfeld is not the top.
Absolutely. People can recall, the mindset after 9/11 that these are horrible people, that Osama bin Laden is at the top of this, and these are terrorists, and we need to deal with terrorists in a different manner. And a conversation between Alberto Gonzalez, he was not the Attorney General at the time, and the President of the United States.
He was the attorney to the lawyer, to the President, rather.
Correct.
His personal attorney.
And recommended to him that this departure from the Geneva Conventions be authorized. And it was authorized because this was a prisoner of a different kind. This was a terrorist. and we needed to remove those protective barriers of the Geneva Conventions. Nobody really paid attention to that decision because we were still reeling from the effects of the attacks on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
However, that authorization did go to the Pentagon. And the guy in charge of the Pentagon, Secretary Rumsfeld, then signed a memorandum authorizing techniques, stress positions, hooding, sleep deprivation, disruption.
Use of dogs.
The use of dogs, however, the use of dogs became very important in Iraq because General Sanchez signed a very lengthy memorandum, 8 pages, that authorized not only the use of dogs in interrogations, but the use of unmuzzled dogs with his specific permission.
And all of this comes out of this mindset of these folks are somehow different from us. I mean, every time we have created a them out of a people, whether it was at the founding of this country when it was African Americans were a them, it justified slavery. It justified, you know, whipping and selling and the abuse of slaves. Whenever we have created a them, and throughout history, whenever there has been a them, you know, when the Germans referred to, you know, themselves as the Übermenschen and everybody else as the Untermenschen, you know, the overmen and the undermen, the Japanese notion that came out of World War II of the superior race. Whenever we've created a them, we end up with these kinds of situations. And in fact, even you look at the history of feudal Europe and you walk through the torture chambers and the old castles in Europe.
Exactly.
And there was an us and there was a them.
And that was prevalent in Iraq. Mm-hmm. It was Saddam, his fedaheen, the Sunnis largely, because Saddam wanted to be accepted by the rest of the Middle East, and they were primarily Sunni-dominated populations. So mm-hmm. he wanted to encourage that Sunni population to be his followers, to be his,
sure.
his strong arm.
And he was Sunni himself.
And he was Sunni himself. But he was certainly open to other religious beliefs, but it was them, even inside of Iraq. So, in fact, we have, instead of departing from that mindset that we were trying to unseat with Saddam, mm-hmm. we have now been found to be guilty of following that same mindset.
Amazing.
That our ideas are somehow better than theirs.
So, in Japan and Germany, we basically broke the brainwashing of a cult. You know, we basically, you know, the Germans and the Japanese, we busted up cults, basically. In Iraq, it sounds like you're saying we actually are reinforcing one.
Right. And it goes largely, if I can, to the funding distribution. The Iraqis felt that with all of this funding coming into Iraq to rebuild, to give them a new road ahead, that it should have been equally distributed between all of the provinces, unlike under Saddam, where he gave the majority of the money to Baghdad and the surrounding vicinity, and what was left was distributed to the other provinces.
Mm-hmm.
So what did we do? We go in and we repeat exactly that process.
Really?
Yes.
We ignored the outer provinces and we put all the money into Baghdad.
Into Baghdad.
Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. We're talking with Dr. Janice... Doctor. With Janice Karpinski, the author of One Woman's Army, the commanding general of Abu Ghraib tells her story. And it's an absolutely remarkable book. I recommend you get out to a bookstore and get a copy. Janice Karpinski, thanks so much for being with us
today.
Thank
you.
I truly appreciate it. And I want again to thank you and honor you for your service to your country, to our country, to this great nation. Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Vampires, mummies, and the Holy Ghost. These are the things that terrify me the most.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Yes, it's Halloween, so sure enough, in order to scare the bejesus out of us, George W. Bush has nominated Sam Alito to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court. An appropriate Halloween nomination, I would say, for those patriotic Americans who believe in justice and liberty and all the, well, in addition to this, we'll get to Alito in just a second here. But in addition to this now here, Dick Cheney has just promoted two members of his staff who are actually named in the criminal indictment against Scooter Libby. Believe it or not, David Addington is now his chief of staff, and John Hanna is going to be his assistant for national security affairs. Addington provided legal counsel to Libby in helping to divulge Plame's identity. This from the actual indictment itself, Article 18 of the indictment. Also on or about July 8th, 2003, Libby met with the counsel to the vice president, that would be Addington, in an anteroom outside the vice president's office. During their very brief conversation, Libby asked the counsel to the vice president in sum and substance what paperwork there would be at the CIA if an employee's spouse undertook an overseas trip. And this is incredible. And here another one regarding Addington and Hanna. Article 13 from the indictment. Shortly after publication of the article in the New Republic, Libby spoke by telephone with his then principal deputy and discussed the article. That official asked Libby whether information about Wilson's trip could be shared with the press to rebut the allegations that the vice president had seen Wilson. Libby responded that there would be complications at the CIA in disclosing that information publicly and that he could not discuss the matter on a non-secure telephone line. David Addington and John Hanna, involved in this whole thing, just promoted by Dick Cheney. Just promoted. Daniel in Whidbey, Washington. Hey, Daniel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to share your appreciation for the honor and courage of Janice Karpinski. It was a great interview.
Yeah, what this woman went through is absolutely mind-boggling, and she does a very, very good job of chronicling it in her book, and in a way that's not at all, you know, hand-wringing. I mean, it's very straight. In fact, the book starts out with her as a child trying on her father's army cap and standing up straight in front of the mirror and deciding, I'm going to go into the army, you know, as like a five-year-old or something.
Excellent.
And, you know, and then carries forward from there and through the whole, you know, the whole mess, and it's a brilliant book.
Well, I had a thought on the nomination of Samuel Alito as first and foremost as a maximum distraction value.
Well, this is what I predicted last week.
But as a political strategy, it's excellent for pleasing the very radical right.
Oh, of course. Bush has to play to his base because without their support, he's toast.
And it spends all of the Democrats' energy making room for the next nomination.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even certain that Alito is intended to be their nominee or expected to be confirmed.
Oh, I think they're going to push him through. We are going to mount as much of a defense as we can against this kind of right-wing extremism on the Supreme Court, but the fact of the matter is that lacking Alito, there's 10 more standing behind him. You know, Priscilla Owen, Janice Rogers, I mean, there's no shortage of them.
Oh,
and Bush has essentially said to the United States of America, he's basically said to all of us, hey, I'm a right-wing extremist, and I don't care what you think. And, you know, he just thumbed his nose at us, because here's a guy with a long judicial record, unambiguous record, of saying, for example, that a woman, before she can get an abortion, has to prove that she has informed her husband of it. I mean, you know, and you can see, I mean, just, it's just incredible. And
it's frighteningly intolerant.
Yeah, and so, but I, you know, we're back to the nuclear option stuff. I really think that this is the kind of case where the Democrats will try and filibuster it. The Republicans will pull a nuclear option. They'll pull out the filibuster. They'll pass it through on a majority vote. This is my prediction. And this guy will be on the Supreme Court because Bush doesn't care. He doesn't have to run for reelection.
I'm just thinking that there has to be enough Republicans who still have a conscience that would join with the Democrats on this.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think you're overestimating the quality of the Republicans in the United States Senate right now, tragically.
Yeah.
I mean, you can count them on one hand. You know, George Voinovich, Olympia Snowe. Yeah, I mean, it's just there's just very, very few left who have any integrity at all, Daniel.
I'm sorry.
And, you know, it's a sad state of affairs.
I would like to be more optimistic, you know, and an old-time Republican would be very valuable at this point.
Yeah, you know, where is Barry Goldwater when you need him?
I mean, now, that's a frightening thought.
Right, who would ever have thought that we'd look back on Barry Goldwater?
We'd be looking for Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, and, well, yeah, it's just incredible. Daniel, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I mean, this is just you know, Everett Dirksen. I mean, you know, where are the classic Republicans? Everett Dirksen was, you know, such a man of integrity back in the 50s and 60s, and in the United States Senate, somebody who would stand up to power and speak out the truth. And now we're getting these right-wing cranks, not somebody who, I mean, Bush, it would have been so easy for Bush to pick somebody who could be agreed upon by both sides. It would have, or for that matter, for him to say to the Taliban, you know, Harriet Myers it is. Who knows? I mean, maybe she would have been a moderate. Frankly, I don't know. I mean, that's the reason why you have hearings in the Senate. But apparently, as she was going around talking to senators, it wasn't the Democratic senators she was talking to who were blowing her off. It was the Republican senators. They were not happy with what she was telling them. So, yeah, we'll see how this one plays out. But I am not encouraged. Although, hopefully, Mr. Fitzgerald will continue doing his job, and even though the House of Representatives and the Senate will not even think about looking into the crimes of the Bush administration, perhaps this prosecutor will. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.